Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Caroline mentioned, I'm Peter Schwartz from Salesforce.com, and I helped found something called the Global Business Network, and I have a really rare privilege tonight. I have two friends on stage, two gentlemen I've known for a long time, hosting Eve Bihar and Tim Brown of IDEO. Eve is a design entrepreneur who believes that holistic product, digital, and brand design are cornerstones of any business. He's the founder and CEO of Fuse Project, not far from here, and the chief creative officer at Jawbone. You have probably in your home many of his products. My wife sits on one of his chairs. I use one of his Jawbone jam boxes. We are really privileged to have him with us this evening. Tim Brown frequently speaks about the value of design thinking and wrote one of the most profound books on the subject, Change by Design. He is the CEO and president of IDEO, probably the company that has really led this charge into the world of design more than any other. He writes frequently. He writes for Harvard Business Review and The Economist. But these two guys, I think, and that's why this hall is full today, are probably changing the world more than anybody else that we know. They're reshaping organizations. They're reshaping designs. They're changing how we deal with the environment. So what we're going to do is we're going to explore three big ideas in the next 45 minutes before we open it up for questions. First of all, what does a designer do? What's a design firm? You know, how has that evolved? Because this is a game that has evolved a great deal. Secondly, we're going to explore what do we mean by design thinking? You know, what are the principles and ideas that inform these gentlemen's work? And finally, how's it changing the world? How is it making it more sustainable? What kind of ways is it influencing all of your lives? So where I want to begin is with Tim Brown. And, you know, Tim, when we were talking in the green room, you mentioned some of the things that you're doing. One that I particularly resonated with was a environmentally friendly toilet for Ghana. As someone who served in the Peace Corps in Ghana, I wish we'd had one when I was there. But equally important, not just physical design, you're designing the user experience for the new health exchanges coming forward. So, you know, you've moved from the world of product design to organization to experience design. Tell us what IDEO does. What's a designer do when somebody comes to you and say, I need your help?
I've always thought of design as at its simplest level as being responsible for that, the sort of interface between us as human beings and the world we make around us, right? Now, a lot of design's unintentional. A lot of that happens by accident. But where it's intentional, when that happens intentionally, it's design. Right? And so whether that's a product, whether it's a service, whether it's a piece of communications, whether it's a space, whether it's a piece of software, whether it's an organization, that's all design. So we're somewhat insatiable at IDEO. Anything that looks like a design problem, we'd love to work on. You know, we rarely say no if it's an interesting design problem. So that takes us off in all kinds of different directions. But what we've found over the time, as we've got to do more and more of this, is that the more perspectives you can come at the design problem from, the better the ultimate end result is. So that means, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to understand people and how they work and how they behave and how they operate, so that we can do a better job of anticipating their needs and revealing their needs. We spend a lot of time playing around and understanding technology, so we understand how we actually might serve the needs of people through something. We spend more and more time trying to understand business, because one of the things that's clear is it doesn't matter how wonderful a product is that you design or a service, if it's not sustainable, if somebody can't actually keep offering it to us, then it doesn't provide a lot of value. So we spend more and more of our time thinking about that. We spend more and more of our time thinking about the systems around the things that we design, because whether it's the systems of supply, how something gets made, the materials that you make it with, the supply chain that gets it to wherever it has to be in the world, and the systems of distribution, how things get marketed, the brand that an object or a service might live within, they're all part of the design problem. So it's multifaceted. It's complex, which is fun, and we've tried to find ways of tackling that by bringing, in many cases, many, many different disciplines together to tackle the design problem. Design isn't one thing, it's many things. Design is much more of a, if you like, a team sport, perhaps these days, than we used to think of it as decades ago. And so we like to bring people with many different kinds of experiences and backgrounds together to tackle design problems.
Say a little more about that collaborative process, because it's, you know, that really is, I think, different than most people imagine. Design, you know, designers, you know, aren't just sort of one guy sitting at a drafting table.
And it's the, and it, I'm, as a designer, I love the idea of tensions, right? I hate making choices about things at some level. I love the idea that we can hold tensions in our heads. And one of the tensions that we hold constantly in the world of design is that it's collaborative, but it's not designed by committee. And getting that balance right, so bringing different perspectives together, having people work together, having different people contribute different pieces, perhaps, of the puzzle, does not mean that you have a bunch of people around a table, somebody doing the left leg, somebody doing the right leg, that's how you end up with camels and all kinds of other ungainly things. And so there's still a role for that creative leap that an individual might take as part of a team. It might be the person who's leading that team. It might be some member of that team. But there's still room for that. There's still room for the individual contribution, but within the context of a broader team.
So, Eve, I mentioned some of your products, but one of the ones that I really love solved a problem for us, right? And I suspect many people. I like drinking fizzy water, right? And I had, mm-hmm. My biggest thing that would go out in the recycling were the plastic bottles that I have a big bin of recycled plastic bottles for my fizzy water. And then you solved my problem with SodaStream. And I love it. I love it. It's a sustainable way of making fizzy water, right? You know, which is water with CO2. So it shouldn't be a very expensive product. And you've transformed that business for myself. What happens when a company like SodaStream comes to Fuse Project and say, hey, we want to reinvent soda?
So I'll throw in a little bit my definition of design and what it does, which, yes, it brings you fizzy water, but it brings you fizzy water because design really accelerates the adoption of new ideas. And the idea that you can have something made just in time, that's a very 21st century idea, that I can have the immediacy of the enjoyment of sparkling water or a soda made at home. The notion that sustainability doesn't have to be complicated or difficult or ugly or expensive, that it's something that is available to all, for example. These are important ideas. And what design does is it makes it palpable. It makes it attainable for a lot of us and hopefully all of us. So SodaStream and our team at Fuse Project is bringing you, fizzy water in a way that's beautiful and simple. But for me, it has to always start with a bigger idea, where the world is going, and design plays a role in that.
Well, in fact, Tim is wearing one of your products over there. You want to show your wrist up there? This, for the radio audience, he's wearing a jawbone, what do you call that?
Up.
Okay.
The up end, yes.
An up end. So tell us a little bit about, sort of what was your thinking about that kind of product?
So we've seen the emergence of sensors around us. Sensors are able to tell us things about our cars, things about our airplanes. But what about if they were able to tell us things about ourselves? I think we're the last generation that knows so little about our own health and our own lifestyle and how it affects our health. And so what it does, it collects data about how much you move. It collects data about your sleep, how well you sleep, and it allows you to look at your life, what you've done the night before, how much you've been drinking, or whether you were too static at work all day long, and it allows you to make changes for the better, hopefully.
So it provides feedback to you on how you're living and what you ought to do.
Exactly. And it's something that really has to be designed so you can wear it all day long, all night long. It's something that has to be designed so you don't have to charge it all the time like your phone. So, it has a 12-day battery life, for example. And so design has a very important role to play in that, because if the engineers had worked on it, the form factor maybe would have not allowed it to be wearable all the time. It would have been maybe more like a medical device, and we know what, you know, how we like to live with those, not very much. So design has a role in bringing, for example, notions, data, and health in a way that we want to actually use it and we want to live with it.
Well, in fact, mentioning health, I mean, IDEO has been involved with Medtronics and medical instruments and so on. I wouldn't be surprised if people have actually interacted with your devices. But you're also, and I think this is a surprise for people, now involved in the experience of what the new healthcare exchanges will be like. So when you think about that kind of design challenge, what are you thinking about there?
They're not, funnily enough, in some ways, they're not that different. I mean, the systems are quite complex. Our goal, as the goal of design very often, is to find ways for tools that are supposed to provide help to us to fit into our lives as seamlessly as possible. Perhaps they make our lives simpler. Perhaps they make our lives richer. So something like a health exchange, which is a tool for helping people pick the right health insurance, which a lot of people are going to have to do very soon with the new Affordable Care Act. It's a complicated process. There are some pretty important implications if you make the wrong choice in terms of getting the right coverage and spending the right amount of money. So all of the concerns there are, how do we present choices in a digital environment? These are all online exchanges. In a digital environment, how do we present choices that are as informative as they need to be, as simple as they can be, in order that people can make good comparisons and they can make good choices? It's not that different from designing a product. It's just that this is in the virtual environment. There was some added complexity as we were designing these things, the policy was getting developed by the government. So we were constantly backwards and forwards trying to understand how the policy itself was going to affect the platform that we were designing. But then that's often the case. I mean, if it's not policy that's changing, it might be the business case that the company's developing. As designers, we have to be used to the idea that the goalposts are moving quite a bit of the time. And what we're trying to do is force everybody involved in the enterprise to make the right choices on behalf of the people who end up using these things, to create something, as I said before, is as seamless, as simple, perhaps, and as rich as possible.
So who was the customer for that product?
Well, in that case, it's ultimately the states that are going to roll out these exchanges. It was the California Healthcare Foundation that funded the program on behalf of the government.
And how do you interact with them? And what happens when they say, "Gee, IDEO, we need to come up with a better way to manage this"?
We put a team together. That team spends about equal amounts of time going out and trying to understand and studying how users might actually go through this process. And then much of the rest of the time, as well as designing it, working in this case with the various policymakers and the folks that were responsible for deciding what these insurance policies were going to be, and we're negotiating constantly between those two things through the tools of design by showing people what it's going to be like. We spend most of our time building things and showing people, hey, if it was like this, this is how you'd use it. If it was like that, this is how you'd use it. And in a way, that's one of the most powerful tools we have as designers, our ability to take ideas, words, objectives, desires, and turn them into reality through the tools of visualization and prototyping.
Well, you started to lay out some of the basic principles that inform your work, Eve. So, you know, when you start thinking about design thinking, you know, what's different from other kinds of thinking? What is it that... As opposed to logical problem solving or mathematics or creative writing, all of which involve thoughtful mm-hmm. processes. What's different and unique about the thought process that informs your work?
Well, design thinking is it's not a philosophy. I mean, I think sometimes people confuse it with some kind of miracle formula. It's a method, and it's a method that can be described as, you know, you need to empathize, observe, research, then you need to sort of brainstorm and lay out a lot of different possibilities, and then you need to prototype, hopefully quickly and efficiently, and then you implement, you execute, you build around this. I think sometimes, you know, design, people have the notion that design thinking is something new or something that, you know, very 21st century. But when I think back of Charles Eames, George Nelson, when I read their writings, when I look at, you know, the way they approach the world, there was plenty of thinking then. And this is what makes, for me, you know, when I look back, great design really stand out, is that it isn't just there for stylistic reasons. It isn't a sort of signature style that somebody with a name or somebody famous is sort of putting on a product. It really inscribes itself in the times that it was created. It really sort of follows the preoccupations or precedes sometimes the preoccupations and you know, the moment in which it was built. So I think, you know, mostly for me, it's a method, it's simply a method to do, you know, to do better design. But design is still accomplished, and it's still, you know, at its full potential when thinking becomes doing. That's, you know, that's what I think, you know, we need to focus on.
So I think an important point, you know, you're not a kind of pragmatic version of Yves Saint Laurent or one of the great fashion designers, you know, which we often associate with the word design. Mm-hmm. It's something far more profound and embedded in the real world in a way that, you know, fashion literally implies fashion, change, so on, turnover,
sure.
And physical design.
Many of the products or the designs that we see that survive, and there are many, and that are still as relevant today as they were, in some cases, maybe even designed 100 years ago, but certainly 30, 40 years ago, mm-hmm. tend to be the ones that got something fundamental right about the relationship between that product or and the person, the user, and that fundamental relationship is still relevant. So whether if it's an Eames lounge chair, for instance, which is, you know, I mean, one of the most...
We saw it in a movie last night, a brand new movie. The shape right. was sitting in an Eames chair.
I mean, one of the most iconic pieces of furniture from the 1950s, you know, that relationship between that chair and the person sitting in the chair is as relevant today as it was when it was designed, and so it's still relevant as a product. Now, that doesn't happen for all products, but in that case it did.
Now, you wrote the book Changed by Design, so I put the question to Eve. What do you think of when you think of design thinking? What are the principles that inform that from your point of view?
I mean, I agree with Eve, absolutely. It's an approach to bringing things into the world, to solving problems, if you will. There are some things that I try to point out to those who aren't used to design and creative thinking, some things that are easy to miss, that are quite fundamental. So one of them is that if we go through a relatively normal education system and we experience sort of normal things you experience at school, and then perhaps you go in, you know, maybe you end up going to business school, that many of the problem solving techniques that you learn are based on the assumption that you're selecting from available choices the best possible option. One of the things that design does, and being creative does, is literally put new options on the table. It creates things that didn't exist before. And that's a very powerful idea, right? That if you're being creative, if you're being a designer, then you are literally causing things to appear that didn't exist before. Now, it turns out that's a relatively rare thing, right? That in most of what business does, for instance, that's not going on at all. Mostly it's about deciding amongst the available existing choices which one is optimal. And so it's important to remember that, is if you're not creating new things, then perhaps you're not designing, you're not being creative. So there are things like that which I think are worth pointing out, but essentially it's the method that Eve described.
I mean, Peter, you mentioned change, and it's a fundamental notion of design, and I would go even further. It's not just change, it's really breaking what was there before. And you know, all of us have experience going to a hospital or a clinic, and that experience probably needs to be broken and rebuilt into something entirely different. A lot of designers today don't just design, they actually create new companies that break the old model. I mean, I would use, you know, Airbnb, for example, you know, as an example. That's two industrial designers who created Airbnb, and they created something that is breaking the old model of the hotel, where you actually go and you stay with somebody that may give you a lot better information about the neighborhood and what to do in the city than the concierge at a certain hotel. So design is for me about a radical change. And we live in an era where change is accelerating, and we have technologies, but we also have, the way people are thinking is very evolving very, very quickly. And so there is an open-mindedness towards moving to completely different business models, and designers are not afraid of breaking things, but they know how to rebuild them. They know how to put them back into something that will become the kind of experience that, that we're looking for in this day and age.
Well, IDEO is involved in designing businesses, isn't that right?
Well, I think it's this idea of being able to grapple with the design of the whole system, right? And so whether it's a business, a venture, or whether it's some other kinds of system like a health system, the if you can pick the right scope, right, and you can certainly try and go too big and it gets too complicated, too hard to resolve, but if you can pick the right scope, and a new venture, a new business is often a really great scope to pick, where you can affect everything, right? So you're not just affecting the product, but you're affecting the brand, you're affecting the business model, you're affecting the organization, and you're bringing design to all of those. It allows you to get to places that you would not have been able to get to if you're only working, let's say, with an existing company and a new product, for an example. Or in another case, I mean, we've just finished working on. We work a lot in education. It's the fastest growing area that we work in, and we love it. Normally we'll get asked, can you help us design this curriculum, or perhaps can we design this school campus? But we've just finished working on a project in Peru where we've got to do the whole thing, a whole new school system that included the schools, the curriculum, the business model, the technology model, the tools that teachers use to share information, absolutely everything. Designed from the ground up.
What kind of people were involved in that? It's a great problem.
I mean, we had folks with education backgrounds who were designers also. We had architects, we had software designers, graphic designers, and then we had a remarkably enlightened client.
And how long does something like that take? I mean,
for the design phase itself was a little less than a year.
And how do you envision the future of it? Because you're not designing for today, you're designing for tomorrow.
Well, it's the same as we were talking about earlier. I mean, you actually have to try and build things as fast as you can. So we were prototyping parts of this new system. We had we had some ideas about how classrooms could be configured differently if you were mixing the kind of education you were delivering. And we're working with Saul Khan, actually, I don't know who many mm-hmm. of you know, on this project. And we were prototyping those new classrooms almost straight away. And so we. Look, whenever you've got a complex system, you need to look for the bits of it you can try out as fast as you can.
So I want to move on to kind of the big issues that design is helping to deal with. And I want to put it in a particular context. One of the other icons of the Bay Area is a guy named Paul Ehrlich from Stanford. And IDEO, I think, came out of Stanford. And Paul wrote the book, The Population Bomb, and really focused the world's attention on population. And he put forward an equation that I think has influenced a lot of people, known as IPAT. Impact, environmental impact equals population times affluence times technology. And it basically says the consequences of what we do is a function of how many of us there are, how we live, and with what technology. Well, we have a pretty good idea there's going to be some more of us. They all want to live reasonably well. So the biggest lever we have on that impact is the technology and the way we do things. So, when you start thinking about that kind of a problem, when we're going to have 9 billion people on the planet in about 25, 30 years, when they all want to live at least as well as we do, and if they did it exactly as we do, we're probably in a lot of trouble. So the question is, how do we think about design in that kind of context with technology, with organization, with behavior, all of that systemic thinking that you were alluding to?
Well, by definition, design is about efficiency, and it's about doing a lot with little. Whether it's in our own process, I mean, we're relatively small firms, IDEO or Fuse Project, compared to often our clients. But we can achieve a lot with little in a short amount of time. But also, design looks at complex systems and works on simplifying them significantly. One example is the Puma shoebox. We called it the clever little bag, which is we reduce the shipping of shoes by 65% by changing the materials by making it reusable, by not printing and not using inks and other chemicals in that process. And we reduced, you know, the amount of diesel that is used for shipping, et cetera, et cetera. But that's looking at a system. And when 80 million pairs of shoes, in this case for Puma and a couple of other brands, are being shipped around the world, a 65% reduction is significant. But when we started on this project, they just kind of hired us to see if we could do a little better. We didn't sort of stick to some 10% or 20% improvement goals. We tried to improve it 100%. We missed the mark. We failed in a sense by only going to 65. But that's
but it's a pretty cool box. I've seen it.
It's interesting because consumers who pick it up at the stores are completely delighted to have something entirely different there. But that's, you know, there's a level of thinking that's very big about logistics, about factories, about production in all kinds of different environments and countries. And there is also a part which is simply about the customer still going to have to love it. It's still going to have to make the brand look good. And so we have to be just as close to the stockroom, you know, employees who have to carry these up the stairs and present it to their customers, to the customer itself, to the people who are actually making these boxes and manufacturing them. But it's by looking at all these different factors that we can address, you know, one problem at a time. The difference in design compared to a lot of other methodologies, you know, if you think about ISO 9000 and, you know, those kind of management tools, is that the solution has to be different every single time. You can't resolve a problem around textiles in the same way that you're resolving a problem around automobiles in the car industry or hospitals. And it's not about standards either, because we're a long way, you know, from those standards. But my thesis is that in the next 20 years, everything is going to have to be redesigned from the ground up. The way we make things, the way we ship them, you know, the way they get to us. And so consumers want a different type of consumption. They still want to consume, but you know, who's going to figure all this out? And so designers being involved, you know, from 0 to 100, in this case, from the very beginning, from the way a factory functions or from the way materials are being used, all the way to the delivery to the consumer, that's a way that a lot of progress can be made.
And what's exciting about at least working here right now is that we are seeing redefinitions of what consumption is, and that's forcing us to redefine what design is. Right? So, whereas, you know, I certainly, when I started in my career, my assumption was that a company would make everything that people bought, right? But now we're starting to see both different forms of ownership. We're starting to see mechanisms for people being able to participate in parts of the design process of the products that they acquire themselves. And it's early in the process, but we've seen it before. We saw it in the 1980s with desktop publishing, when printing graphic design suddenly became accessible to everybody. It was awful at the beginning, and then as the tools got better and design got better and designers got better. Actually, designers were forced to get better. Professional designers were forced to get better because everybody was doing it all of a sudden. We're just starting to see the same thing with product design with 3D printing.
Now, I want to go back to this notion of the experience that you're creating for people. And you use the word efficiency and you, Eve, and also the word delight. You know, and I think many of us have had the experience of having miserable experiences in interacting with organizations. And every once in a while, you interact with a bureaucracy. California DMV today is a delight to deal with.
Really?
It's hard to imagine saying that, but it actually is. You know, I mean, it's very simple, efficient. It's very efficient, minimizes the time to get your license renewed and so on, and sets up appointments online, and it's a very easy experience. Virgin Airlines, an amazing experience. They really delight you, and so on.
Have you tried to renew your passport lately?
Not so delightful.
That's not a delight.
Delightful. Or getting a visa to go to India, not so delightful. But having said that, when you design experiences, do you think that way?
Absolutely. But here's the interesting thing: is the bar is raising all the time, and the
right.
Wonderful thing, you know, what I love is every time somebody designs something really great, it raises the stakes for everybody. So that encourages everybody to think about how, you know, so what's acceptable in the world of service has changed a lot in the last 20 years. And I mean, one of the best examples I can think of is happening in the UK at the moment, where the government 2 years ago decided to create this new government digital design service, a centralized design service for the UK government. And these guys, and
sounds almost like an oxymoron.
It sounds like it, but you walk into their building in the West End, and it's like walking into Facebook. They've got 250 of the best developers in Europe, and they took 200 and something websites down to one single website for all government digital services in the UK in 18 months, and it's wonderful. I'd really encourage anybody who wants to go and see great civic design, go look at UK.gov, and it's remarkably elegant, great design, and it's reset the standard. Now there are a bunch of private organisations who can't live up to what the British government does, which is, you know, that isn't going to last very long. So I love the fact that that whenever great design happens, whether it's Virgin, whether it's whoever it is, that it raises the stakes and it gives us a chance to make everything better.
Yeah, what's so fascinating to me is that the consumer does not have any patience for disconnected experiences anymore.
Oh, yes.
They're experiencing things that are much more fluid, much easy, practical, delightful, and they expect that from everything. And when they don't get that, they let you know. It's a very different time that we live in compared to the 80s and the 90s, where essentially it was 30 seconds advertising on TV, and that's what you got. Mm. The product never changed. Maybe the advertising campaign did. Consumers, can't stand that anymore. They have a much higher standard, and they demand, better service and better design all the time.
Right. And the thing that's interesting is that's not just a phenomenon in developed markets and developed countries. I mean, as we work more and more through our nonprofit arm, which we have, idea.org, in Africa and South America, we're realizing that what we might have thought as being the kind of rather more esoteric pieces of design are just as important. So, for instance, the toilets that we were designing that you mentioned earlier, the design was a whole system. It's a whole service system with a kind of an entrepreneurial service as part of it. And we learned very early on that it was going to be almost impossible to get consumers interested and entrepreneurs interested unless we had a really sophisticated brand. Because it turns out, actually, in these markets, that the normal infrastructure is untrustworthy, and so brands actually provide trust. They're even more important than they are here. And so developing a sophisticated, meaningful brand around that business was just as important as it was for, you know, Eve when he developed the Jawbone and the Up brand. And so it turns out that these tools that we have as designers are important no matter where we're talking about in the world.
Yeah, I think there's something very important you said there that I think is worth keeping in mind. That just because people are poor, not particularly well educated, is that they have lower standards for the things they want.
If anything, they have higher standards
because
they don't have the spare income to be able to waste money on things. So products actually have to be of a higher quality. They have to be more reliable than they might have to be here. We may have to use a lot less resource and be a lot more clever about how we create those products in order to make them less expensive. They have higher standards, I would argue, not lower standards.
There is a proverb from Finland that says the poor can't afford bad design, right. Bad quality.
Right on.
And we know how they make things last in Northern Europe.
Yeah, if you visit the favelas of Rio, you see an enormous amount of creative design when you walk down those narrow, hardly streets, and you see people solving all kinds of problems that, you know, have to be solved in a highly inventive way, durable, efficient. Do you study those kinds of people for ideas and so on, or those sources?
Well, we don't just study those people from afar. I mean, we spent a lot of time. Currently, I have some of our designers just came back from South Africa. We're about to go to Rwanda, for example. There is actually an interesting phenomenon, which is a lot of brands think that, okay, we need to be we need to be cutting edge, you know, in Germany, in the United States, and in developed countries. But what we have found out through, you know, primary and secondary research is that actually there is a lot more acceptance for change and cutting edge design in the developing world than there is here. Because here we're, you know, it's hard for us to change our habits. You know, we're creatures of habits, and the idiosyncrasies that have been sort of passed on to us generations by generations by you know, companies and governments, we're tolerant with them. But if you do develop a product for India or for China, you can actually, this is extraordinary to me, you can actually do better design, go further, and present something more on the cusp of new ideas, new aesthetic and new functionality than here sometimes.
And we're very fortunate. We now have teams permanently based in China and India, and we have teams in, we've got a team in Mozambique right now. We've got teams in South America, and we're actually not just learning from those cultures and those experiences and bringing them back to organizations in, you know, in the West, but we're actually designing for those cultures, and so we're having to learn from them in order to design appropriately for them. And as brands move from the developed markets to China to India, it's not enough for them to assume, particularly when it comes to the pieces of brands that are not just about the functionality, but about the emotional connection they might have with people. It's not enough to assume that whatever was successful for them in the West is going to be successful for them when they get to these new markets. So they have to understand. And so, if you're an anthropologist, amateur or professional, design's a great place to go play, because you get to learn a lot about people.
Does ideas flow this way from them to us?
More and more so. I mean, you know, I'm sure people have heard of that. You know, there's been this whole sort of kind of meme around, you know, reverse innovation and bringing ideas from developing markets to the West. And you know, the one of the core ideas around that is that innovations that work in highly constrained marketplaces can still be relevant when they come somewhere like here. So I think GE has the example of the handheld ultrasound scanner that I think got developed in India originally and then came here. And I think we are going to see more and more of that. There are healthcare innovations going on in Africa and India today, incredibly clever, incredibly efficient, that could have huge benefit to us here in the United States or in Europe if we could bring them here.
Yeah, we tend to overthink and overcomplicate things sometimes over here. So seeing those simpler, more efficient solutions that are happening around the world is an indication that things could go that way here too.
Well, you know, something you worked on with a mutual friend of ours, Nicholas Negroponte, right, mm-hmm. was the one computer per child. And yet, it must be now 2 years ago, I was in Jakarta, and I saw a little black device called a Maxin. It happens to look exactly like a BlackBerry. It is made with inexpensive Chinese chips and some illicit software, and it's basically a smartphone for less than $100, mm-hmm. and with a full Internet connection. Over the cellular network, and suddenly you've got what amounts to a mini computer with full access to the World Wide Web, access to Wikipedia, all the knowledge available to any kid for $100 in Jakarta. And that came out of there rather than the other way around. I mean, as much as I admire and the beauty and the elegance of the computer which you designed and the vision, which I think actually inspired a lot of this coming back the other way, one of the wonderful things that I think has actually happened is it's leapfrogged. The infrastructure of the mobile system moved so fast mm-hmm. that we were able to get out there in the world capabilities, and now they're flowing back to us, it seems to be.
Well, and just as importantly, not just the sort of the capabilities of developing the hardware and the software, or hacking the software in the case that you mentioned. There is also how the ideas are moving so fast. The notion that you know, children can learn by themselves, can teach their siblings, can instruct their parents out of using technology and having technology at their disposal. That was almost blasphemy, you know, 6-7 years ago. And today, I just came back from the TED conference, and not just the TED Prize, but also the X Prize, the $20 million X Prize, are all based on providing children who don't have access to school, there's 100 million of them around the world, with technologies that will allow them to learn on their own and to develop these skills thanks to new methodologies and technologies. And that's so designs such as a $100 laptop are there to motivate others, but also to change our notions of the effect and how it can actually achieve things that seemingly seem impossible. Educating 100 million kids that do not have access to any type of classroom or books is one of the challenges of the 21st century, and we're going to want to solve it.
And we may be beyond the book era in which that happens.
Everything we've talked about is already, but one of the powerful things about design is it makes the future and brings it to the present, right? And sometimes that happens through new ideas that get out to the market, like one laptop per child, that inspires a whole series of other people to think about things, because suddenly this is now the present. It's no longer some possible future. It's now the present. This thing exists. Sometimes it's done in the way that design can create visions of the future. And, I think back to 30 years ago when a little team at Apple created a little video called the Knowledge Navigator. You'll remember
it,
Peter, right? It essentially defined convergence.
It was the iPad,
it was the Newton, it was the smartphone, it was online video, it was everything that we have today was configured and imagined by that little team at Apple 30 years ago. It set Apple on its path. It set a lot of other organizations on their paths. And that was a design scenario. That was a bunch of people came up with a new design, made a movie of it. And it had a tremendous impact on Silicon Valley, in my opinion. I mean, you're mm-hmm. better able to judge than I am.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but I just want to say one thing to our audience. It's about 5 minutes till question time. So start thinking of your questions. You can start lining up at the mics. But let me remind you, you get one question. Try to keep it brief when you do. No multi-part questions to get it in, and make it a question, not a lengthy statement. So if you want to start lining up on the mics in about 5 minutes, I'll start calling on you. But I want to go back to that. I had the privilege of working with Steven Spielberg on Minority Report, mm-hmm. and we put on screen a bunch of visions. And what I'm astonished by, because we had the Knowledge Navigator precisely in mind. You said, mm-hmm. if we can create a vision of the future that's sufficiently compelling, it will actually bring it into being. And one of the things that I think is different about Silicon Valley isn't that they plan for the future, they make it happen. It isn't, let's see, what will happen 20 years from now? It is, we're going to create the future by design.
The difference, I mean, I read all the science fiction books when I was a kid, and I absolutely truly believe that everything that's in there is happening to us as we speak. That said, a lot of the vision in Hollywood and in science fiction writers is dystopian. It's about all the bad things that could happen with technology. And the difference is that in Silicon Valley, it tends to be more utopian.
Yes.
It tends to be mm-hmm. about the positive impact that it has. I mean, of course, there are, we're constantly mitigating, the negatives and privacy and sometimes it feels like we're like a bunch of children who just discovered a new toy and can't get rid of it for a while, right? With the way that we use technology today. That said, overall, there's a utopian view that technology and design work on together.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think that is one of the unique characteristics of California more generally, and the Bay Area in particular. It's one of the reasons I live here, why I set up my company here, because this is where the future is being born precisely, even because I think people imagine that they can build a better world mm-hmm. by design, by invention, by creating businesses. And I want to go back to something that you said, Tim, about designing businesses. Is the business today that people are designing different than the business before in some important way?
I think you mentioned it earlier. I mean, design is part of business conception today in a way that it was not 20 years ago. It wasn't when I moved to Silicon Valley in the 80s. Their business conception then was very much engineering-led, technology-led, and then we got actually hired to do the design afterwards.
Yeah, right?
I mean, basically, we got hired to say, hey,
darn it, people don't know how to use this stuff. Can you kind of help us? But that's not what's happening today. What's happening today is design is at the very heart of the conception of very many of these new businesses. I think that's incredibly exciting. And I think it will lead to many, many new businesses being more successful faster than they would otherwise have been.
Yeah, I would add something to this, which is quite often design actually creates a turnaround. We were engaged by are sort of creative co-founders of a company, of a new gaming company called Ouya. And nobody wanted to, nobody believed in the notion of an open gaming platform because the three large companies that kind of own that space are too scary and the competition is too big. And who is going to build a new console and a new controller and how are you going to compete with that? And so we couldn't and we didn't raise any money for the company. Instead, we took the idea, we designed it, we designed the experience, we designed the product, we designed the brand to sound exciting, like the name of the brand is Ouya. And we put it on Kickstarter, and 63 or 65,000 people put their name down, put some money down. We raised $8.5 million in a month. And you know, we, in fact, in a week, we're launching, you know, the product and shipping it to now 80,000 customers.
It's really cool. I mean, Kickstarter is a wonderful illustration of the power of design.
Yes.
Because we're seeing now regularly seeing ideas on Kickstarter, designed products raise multi-million dollars, and that, you know, that couldn't be done before, right? You had to go and convince a VC to give you some money to go let you design the thing and get it out there. Now, basically, you know, people are pre-buying stuff. It's incredibly powerful, and it is the power of design. These are prototypes. These are designs that have yet to be made, and yet people are committing to them. It's
yeah, I think the social era of design, of collaboration, of funding, this is, I think, a really radical paradigm shift that's really quite wonderful in terms of engagement and community. Well, I think we're ready to move to our Q&A, but before we do that, a little reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club Inforum. Connect your intellect, and tonight we're hosting design thinkers Eve Bihar and Tim Brown. So we're now ready for our questions. We'll take the first question from over here. Please keep it brief.
The question I have, your conversation mostly focuses on designing things and designing experiences. My question is more around social design. And where it comes from is that our society is, for example, designed for consumerism and not for citizenship necessarily. Our organizations are designed for control and compliance and not so much to maximize human potential. How do you approach social design with design thinking?
I mean, from my perspective, the route to better social systems in terms of what I can do as a designer, I think is to try and make the tools that support those systems be better. So, for instance, I was talking about digital services from government, right? I mean, if we can make government more accessible to people by making those tools better, then we will get people more engaged from a civic perspective. If it's confusing, if it's inaccessible, if they can't find information, if they don't know about things, then it's very hard for them to engage. So my view is that as a designer, that's the place I can make a difference. I mean, I would love to develop a point. I would love to feel that I could actually design organizations themselves. And we're trying, we're learning how to do that maybe, but we're a long way from being able to say that we know how to do that.
I would add to what just Tim said, that design is human-centric. It starts with the individual. It starts with a person. It starts with humanity in many ways. And in that sense, it's very different from the way organizations or governments are engineered. If we think of designing them more, designing those in a social fashion, then I think we would get to new and different places.
You know, I must say, when we started GBN, Global Business Network, with my collaborators back in 1987, it was because we wanted to do something, help organizations think about the future. But we designed a network organization, which turned out to be actually one of our most important innovations,
right.
That the organizational form we invented quite is an instrument to achieving the goal we wanted. And that wasn't our intent, but may have been our most important contribution. Okay, next question over here. Please keep it brief.
Hi, my name's Peter Giselle. My question's for Mr. Brown regarding OpenIDO software platform and how it's being used at the Knight Foundation News Challenge this year. I submitted a proposal 25 days ago, and it took me four efforts to get it on. On Monday, 400 people submitted their entries and crashed the system, and it took 24 hours to bring it back up. What does that have to say about design thinking and human behavior?
It means that technology and servers aren't always as reliable as you'd like them to be. That's what happens when you're designing on the edge. We're actually really excited about what's happening through through the OpenIDO platform, which is a place where we have 50,000 people actually submitting ideas, working on social challenges. Doesn't crash very often. Mostly people seem to be able to get the stuff on there that they want to get on there. And what's most exciting is we're seeing people collaborating across vast distances. People in Finland collaborating with people in Australia to work on food problems. We're seeing teams form. We're seeing ideas evolve in a way that just wasn't possible if all you could do was bring physical teams together to work on stuff. So I agree. We got a long way to go, and it'll get better. But it's a prototype.
Over here.
Hi, Cody Carroll, SY Partners. My question is, if design changes the notion of what's possible, I'd like to know what each of your ideal dream projects would be.
Yeah, and how will design change? When you think about where it's moving forward.
Your dream project?
I get asked this question all the time.
Me too.
And what's your dream project? And what's been interesting in the last 20 years since I've been here in San Francisco is I never seem to get a dream project, but I turn them into one, meaning a shoebox is a rather humble type of project. I would not have said here to you, my dream project is a shoebox. That said, there are ways to turn, and this is what I tell, our incredible team at Fuse Project, is that all these projects that come in, there are ways to turn them into dream projects, not just for us, but mostly for the people who are going to be using them.
I completely agree with that. I mean, that's half of the creative act is, in fact, figuring out how to frame the problem in a way that is interesting, exciting, stimulating. It's hard to find challenges that are not exciting. Having said that, I do really want to design a space station one day.
All right. Me too. I wanted to be an astronaut.
Well, you're doing a starship now.
Yeah, I'm working on the starship project myself.
Okay. I volunteer to come and help?
I'm headed out toward maybe Proxima Centauri. Okay, over here.
Hello. There's a lot of work being done right now on bringing the design thinking process to the classroom for children. And I'd love to hear you talk about what you think the benefits are in bringing children to an understanding of the design thinking process.
Well, children are so innately creative that they're ready for the design thinking process any day of the week. I grew up in Swiss schools about a few years ago, and there was not a whole lot of design thinking then. It was about learning. It was about teaching, actually. It was about being taught. But it seems like in the Bay Area now, there's a large number of schools, from K schools to pre-K schools to high schools that have design courses, and from what I hear, they're very well attended and deeply loved. So we're probably raising a whole generation that's going to compete with us.
Right on.
Well, there's no shortage of need. I mean, I think it's a couple of years ago. I think it was IBM did a survey across thousands of CEOs around the world, looking at what they saw as the biggest needs for, and the things that would concern them most. They're looking forward, and the answer came back very strongly that they were most concerned about about volatility in the world, and they believed that the best response to that was going to be innovation and creativity within their organizations. So that's a bit different from what CEOs were just saying 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And so I believe we need to be creating many, many more kids coming out of their school experiences and their college experiences feeling confident about their ability to be creative in many different ways, whether that's creative in the sciences, creative in design, like we are, creative in the arts, creative politically, but just being the ability and confidence to be more imaginative, to have the tools at their disposal to be more imaginative, to know how to express themselves, to feel confident that when they put a new idea out there, even if people don't necessarily like it, they have the confidence to take that up, put that idea out there, the confidence to take risks. So much of what we've done in education has been to take risk tolerance out of students rather than building it in, and these sorts of experiences of making things, building things, designing things, doing projects in teams, learning how to live in a kind of a project-oriented world. All of these help build this confidence.
As a parent, a significant amount of my assets are tied up in Legos. Yes. From my son, you know, they're still in the bedroom. Yes. You know, I don't know how much we spent on, but watching him and one of his young friends design a Xerox machine out of Legos that could actually copy the Wired logo, was quite a remarkable experience. You know, so I think some of the tools around for kids have been around for a long time, and I can't think of anything better than Legos for, you know, stimulating design creativity.
It was the first product I ever remember building. I built a flashlight out of my Lego for my mother when we were in the middle of big power cuts in England in the 1970s, so that she could cook my dinner.
real problem solving.
It was real problem solving, absolutely.
Okay, over here, another question.
Hello. From everything I hear, it seems like design thinking is a very intuitive approach to solve or like designing experiences and creating experiences. Why do you think bad design happens?
Ah, good question. Where does bad design come from?
A lot of it comes from a lack of intention. I mean, an awful lot of the world that we create around us, we don't stop and think about it and design it. We just do it, or we let it happen, or we assume that the way it's always been is the way that it should. I mean, sometimes we give intentional design and put it in the hands of the wrong people. That can be a problem. But very often it's just a complete lack of attention and intention. And so remembering that something could be designed is actually a pretty good first step.
Well, bad design is everywhere, but I can't live looking around for bad design and moaning about it. I agree. It's lack of intent and lack of focus. It also ends up that everything around us is designed, and very few things around us are designed with designers. I'm not saying there aren't any bad designers, but I'm saying that, if you look at most of the systems that we experience and most of our everyday experiences, there were certainly, they're legacy quite often, and there was certainly no design thinking and no designers involved in those experiences.
The questioner said something I want to ask you to expand on, which was about intuitive thinking. But my impression, I mean, it's certainly good creative intuition is part of this, but isn't there also kind of a rigorous understanding of engineering, of materials, of processes, human behavior, at a really kind of deep level?
I don't know of any creative process that doesn't involve a lot of rigor. I mean, great painters are incredibly rigorous about the skills that they acquire in order to look, see, understand, and create. All the physical skills involved in putting paint on canvas or sculpting, whatever it might be. So any creative process, music, design, whatever, requires a lot of rigor and the creative leap and the imagination.
I think we all are rediscovering this notion of craft. Because we're looking for quality, because consumers are so much more sophisticated today, people are starting to talk about craft. And they're talking about craft in other ways, the way a software is put together or the way something is an experience is well, thought out. And so we're coming back to a place where, when people said craft is dead, It's just the reverse. We need to craft everything with the kind of attention to detail and obsessiveness, even that makes them as great as they are.
Now, let me say we're only going to have time for a couple more questions. So, here.
Thank you, gentlemen. While everyone in this room can get very excited about the idea of design and bringing a better future into the present, when you go into large organizations, bureaucracies, etc., often there's tremendous cultural inertia getting in the way of affecting change. Could you comment on what you've typically done to affect cultural change so that the great ideas can actually come into realization?
I mean, that is a common experience. You go into an enterprise and they tell you they want to change, but then you spend a lot of time reminding them that you're trying to create the change that they ask you to bring along to them. I think it's almost a biopic in a sense that there's two elements at work here. One is they do want to change. On the other, they're burdened by processes and methodologies and I would say even cultural elements that prevents them from getting there. I think we often say that, you know, we need to get sort of top management alignment and to, you know, have CEOs really drive that, and that is true. But at the same time, if that drive isn't clearly communicated and embraced and digested by the entire organization, it's also, it would be impossible for some of these things to happen. So I would say for us, there needs to be a movement at both ends. There needs to be the larger part of the organization that absolutely want it to happen and culturally is working hard at doing so. And then there needs to be the CEO with the CMO and the top management with tools to instill that cultural change within the organization.
So we found two things that have been really important for us time and time again. One is we have to be incredibly good storytellers. Right? Mm. I mean, you have to be able to bring an idea to life in such a way that it starts to do work on its own behalf, as it were, within the organization. It's like any other meme. It needs to spread itself. And so being great storytellers, and these days, you know, we used to think just making a beautiful object was enough. Now we have filmmakers and writers and all kinds of people who work with us to craft beautiful stories and compelling stories about why we're doing what we're doing. So that's one thing that helps. The other one is often bringing people from the organization through some of the experience itself. I mean, I've had the whole top management of Fortune 100 companies out in, you know, Berkeley doing user observations or building prototypes on the floor in our shop, just not because I think they're going to design the end result, but because going through the experience starts to give them an understanding of why we're doing what we're doing.
Well, we have one otherwise would be broken-hearted questioner gets to ask the final question before we get to the traditional last question. Here we go.
Thank you so much. My question is, what's new in design this year in 2013 in the last 3 months or the next 9 months?
I would say two things. One is this notion of the design entrepreneur, the designer as a business builder, the designer as creating the entire context ecosystem for a business to grow into itself. I think the second is this idea that that there isn't a mass market per se anymore. That mass production is going to evolve towards mass customization or mass individualization, and that the technologies that are being developed today will allow for different results to come out of the use of products or going through experiences. I think those two elements for me are kind of what gets me up in the morning.
Jim?
So I'd build up a little bit on that and say the idea of designing with rather than just for people. So I mentioned it earlier, the idea that we all participate in the design process in various ways. That's something that seems to be getting more and more important. And then looking out a little bit, and I'd say this is an idea that's just emerging, and which is the interaction between as design starts to grapple with biological systems. So I have designers working at UCSF learning how to do synthetic biology because I know we're going to be designing living organisms before we're done in our careers, right? There'll be materials at the beginning, but we will be designing things that are using living material. And so we have to understand that. We are designing much more complicated systems than we were designing before. And biology has a lot to tell us about how that happens and how that works. And so this relationship, I've always been interested in the relationship between design and science, but I think the relationship between the design and biology is going to get stronger and stronger as we look forward.
I've seen the first biological printer. Quite remarkable.
Right.
So we now have our final question. It's the tradition here at Inform to ask each of you this final question, and that is, what's your 60-second idea for changing the world for the better? Eve, you're up first.
Oh, boy. Okay, so changing the world is going to mean not taking the world as de facto. Is essentially challenging it and seeing everything as a design opportunity. Whether you are at a hospital, whether you bring your kids to school, whether you're driving a car or a bus, is for me to see design as a movement. If we're going to be asking for everything to be better, then it will be. But we need to start by asking.
Tim,
I want to see a shift in the balance. We've been applying enormous amounts of creative energy and design to the business and commercial world for 120 years. I'd like us to take even some proportion of that and apply it to the important, difficult to solve, complex social challenges that we have in all parts of the world. The only way we're going to pull that off is to educate a lot more people to be designers and to be design thinkers. And so step one, as the gentleman was just talking about, get a lot more design into the education process. Step two, apply that to many more of the challenges that are going to make the biggest difference in the world.
Well, great answers. I hope you will all join me in acknowledging that out of these two fertile minds, a great deal of the future is being born.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.